and gentlemen, welcome to episode 23 of Just Slap Podcast, the pound-for-pound number one tennis podcast in the game. Your host, Steven Duca, Alex Macazzario, joined here by the former coach of Fordham University, St. John's, Nicholls State, and favorite coach, Mr. Frank Russo. How you doing, Frankie?
That's a hell of an intro, Steve.
I know. it took a couple tries, but, you know, what are you going to do?
We got there eventually.
For people that don't know, I think it's important to start by saying that I, unlike Alex, had the great honor and privilege of being coached by you only for a year, because then you ended up going on to bigger and better things and you decided to leave us. But that's besides the point. It was an honor being taught by you for a year. You happen to be probably the funniest guy that I've ever met in my entire life. So I'm really excited for today's episode. I feel a lot of bleeps coming, Alex. So you're going to have a bit of
tougher time. I'm prepared. I'm prepared.
your work is definitely cut out on the editing side for this episode, but I'm excited for all the stories. Frankie, thanks for joining us, man.
You got it, anytime.
So let's get in like straight away. Let's talk a little bit about your background when it comes to tennis. How'd you get into the sport? For people that can't see you, you're about what, like 6'7", and 6'7" lean. That's the best way to describe your body, I'd say. We got a little bit of technical difficulties. We probably missed that. Maybe try to get back into the frame because people can't see you.
Frankie, I don't know if you heard what Steven said, but, you know, considering your build, why tennis, man? What was the decision there? I mean, you are probably the least, you are built like a brick. I mean, you are, you know, what was the decision going into tennis?
You know, I went to, when I was a kid, I used to go to sleepaway camp in Pennsylvania, and I had every sport that you could imagine, you know, and I don't know how, but I end up in a tennis tournament. And I end up winning the tournament. And I happened to realize at a pretty early age that I just happened to be better than the average Joe. But truth be told, tennis was not my favorite sport growing up. It was football. So I played three sports in high school, basketball, football, and tennis. But I knew I wasn't going to play center for the league in basketball. So that was the end of that. And, you know, tennis and football. And football, I just happened to get my bell rung pretty good in high school. So my mother used to come to the matches with her hand over her face because she didn't want to see me get hurt to begin with. So that was the end of football. And tennis, I excelled at in as a junior in tournaments and in high school. And in high school, I took on the mantra of you know, playing sort of as your backboard or your pusher or the guy that gets every ball back and drives you bananas until you lose your mind and you quit. And it was fun to watch. And then I got to college and I was humbled pretty quickly at a big regional tournament, the ITAs. You know, I got a bad draw. What are you going to do? But I was humbled as a freshman and I realized that playing the way that I was playing was just not going to, it just wasn't going to work out. So you had to develop a weapon and, you know, finally sophomore year, I started hitting the forehand and I don't want to bring up any sore subjects, but Steven has seen that in person, in the flesh. And I'm glad this is called Just Slap because he gave me a ball middle third, Alex, and I had to slap it and just show him who his daddy was.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I knew the story was going to get brought up 100%. I didn't think it was going to get brought up this early. Listen, you did win that point. I have to give it to you. I also was working for you at the time, and it was in front of your clients. So, I mean, who really won, right? Because if I did not give you that floater in the middle of the court for you to show off in front of all of your, you know, your Westchester and Connecticut students, you know, maybe I wouldn't have a job the next day. But that's besides the point. So yeah, you mentioned playing tests, but what? When did you decide to start coaching?
You know, I had a bad situation in college. You know, my senior year of college, they announced that they were cutting the program the following year, which was, you know, it's funny, looking back, it was a tough experience because, you know, my freshman year, I came in, we weren't very good. And I was playing one and getting buried. By the time I was a senior, I was playing 4 and 5 and we were winning a lot of matches. And midway through the year, they told us that they were cutting some programs and we were one of them. So once I got out of college, I didn't want to see a tennis racket for a while. I really didn't. And then my program in Darien started to, you know, to flourish and get bigger and bigger each season. And, I started to get an itch to coach at a higher level. And a guy that you guys know very well, Mike Souter, there was a position posted, and ironically enough, Souter was a rival in college. Souter went to Marist, and I was at Iona. And fortunately enough, I never played Souter because I think I would have had a headache. But so I sat down with him and we spoke. And the following week, I was at your practice. Quite frankly,
I think. I you know, it's so sad. I feel like it's a tragedy that I never got to play under you. Cause I, the first thing I heard, you know, when I got there is all the rage about you, you know, it's like you really had an impact on that team. So it's really tragic. Also, I feel like I think you recruited one player, right? You recruited Max, but that was about it. So I never really got to meet you there. I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, you either had no idea I was coming on, or you were like, don't recruit this guy. It's one of the two. I'm not sure which one it is.
I think it was the second one.
We had a few of each. I don't really remember who was who, but what's funny is when I went to go recruit Green got buried. He got beat up pretty good. And I was lukewarm on Green. And Mike had come later on and, you know, I gave the lukewarm, but, you know, Mike was the boss, but you know what, to Mike's credit and actually to all three coaches that I've worked with, I really appreciate that they sort of, and to Mike's credit, especially gave me a long leash. You know, Mike, it's funny, Mike and I are two obviously very different personalities. You know, Mike is laid back Australian. He's got the flowing brown hair and all that other shit. You know, myself, it's not. But we work very well together. And I thought that to his credit, he was bringing in a lot of character guys. Mike was the type of coach who he would bring in a 12 instead of a 12-5 if he thought that he had potential and he was willing to bust it in practice and he was a good character guy. And I think the best part about your Fordham team and both your Fordham teams, actually, when Stephen and when I was there and Alex, when you come in, you know, let's call a spade a spade. We weren't the most talented team in the conference. We weren't even close. But Mike deserves a lot of credit, I think, for both working with me and us putting in a lot of work to get you guys to where you got to. And I firmly believe Souter should have been A-10 coach of the year when you guys, the COVID year. When you have a school in the A-10 that has 10 or 12 teams, whatever it is, and every team has scholarship money and Fordham has zero on the men's side, for you guys to go to conference tournaments, you know, thinking about 4 seeds, 5 seeds, 6 seeds, it says a lot about the job that the coach is doing there. he's done a good job recruiting high character kids, kids that come from good backgrounds, not trouble kids. You know, you guys were never really getting into trouble or anything like that. You know, there was one or two, you know, minor things, but good grades, no nonsense kids. When we rested our head at night, we knew that we were able to sleep and our phone wasn't going to ring, you know? And I think between the camaraderie on that team for 2, 3, 4 years even, I think that's what really propelled you guys to do as well as you did. Because quite frankly, I mean, how does a school like Fordham with no scholarships on the men's team, how do they beat a squad like Dayton? I mean, you know, or a team with 2.5, 3.5, 4 scholarships, that's unheard of. And Souter's done a really good job over there, and I'm glad he's gotten the director's position. I'm glad he got the woman's job. He's had that program on the up and up, the men's program. He'll do the same with the women, and he's aces, that guy, and I owe a lot to him and to the Nicholls State coach Greg Harkins, and I learned from him a lot when I was down in Louisiana. I learned from Dylan Potash over at St. John's. I think in order, and Mike in particular, because we're talking about Fordham a little bit, he deserves a lot of credit because Mike is the type of guy who he listens and he learns, and he even taught me, you know, to be a sponge, and I think that has helped us both become much better coaches.
I feel like, you know, one thing, it's interesting that you say that Mike was predominantly focused on recruiting based on character. I mean, I agree, you know, knowing Mike over the years, but everything, even though I've never, you know, played under you, everything I hear about you though is about how well you connect with the players, how well you motivate the players. And we've spent some time around each other, and you seem like a type of guy who's also very focused on character and on character building. So when you recruit, is that something that you focus on as well, like predominantly, or are you more of a numbers and performance guy?
That's a loaded question, you know, because, and I'm going to tell you why. Okay. I'll give you a perfect example. So I'm at St. John's, and you have a rookie coach, essentially, a rookie head coach who brought me on, right? And I understand how wins and losses are so important at the end of the day, right? But you got to be able to sleep at night, man. You know, you got to be able to not worry about nonsense, because there's too many things going on, you know, but between recruiting and practices and who feels sick and who missed class and who's doing, you know what I mean? That, like, there are things that you don't want to worry about as a coach, and one of them is, you know, on a Friday night that you could lay your head down and not worry about getting a phone call. And that was never the case at Fordham. And when I was at St. John's, you know, you had a rookie head coach who, ironically enough, was very careful. Dylan was very careful about crossing his T's and dotting his I's when he got there, you know, because his thought is, you know, this is my first head coaching job at a Division I level at St. John's. We can win. Like, let me not ruffle any feathers. And then he brings me in and I'm a ruffle feathers guy, right? but it's not, you know, anything with the AD, but or the department or the anything like that. But I'm a no nonsense guy, right? So I expect you to come to work day in and day out and to practice day in and day out and do the right thing, just like you should see me doing the same thing day in and day out. And I remember the very first practice at St. John's, it was raining out. And I was like, well, I don't give a shit. I want these guys on the court as soon as possible. And I came down, drove down an hour over the bridge, and I start squeegeeing. And those guys came out, and they're like, this guy is insane. He's out of his mind. It's raining. And I'm like, I will get this rain off the courts, and we will practice. Okay? And Potash, you know, we can look back on our left, and he's like, we're not practicing. What if one of the guys slips? Then I got to worry about the athletic department and all this other stuff. And I'm just like, no, we're getting these dry, and we're getting these guys on court. And what's so funny is after some of the guys graduated, because I keep relationships with my guys. I believe that's important. You know, they mentioned that first day and that first practice and about how I was squeegeeing. And I think it sets a precedent in the building and outside the building. Okay. You know, I mean, coaches out there busting his ass. Wouldn't it be embarrassing for me to come and not bust mine? You know, and if guys don't want to work, I'm the type of guy, okay, that's fine. Don't work. You'll sit. No problem. I don't have a problem with that. You know, we had and it's funny. It's like, everyone is treated fairly, but not everyone's treated the same, right? Okay, everyone's treated fairly, but not everyone's treated the same, and it's true because everyone has different situations, everyone has different things going on, and you have to treat guys. Some guys with kid gloves. Some guys you could say things to that you're not going to say to other guys. Okay, I could go to Steven's court. We could be on a change. And I could turn to him and say, you know, what the f*** is going on here, right? But if I did that, you know, to he would have turned around and looked at me and been like, and then checked out, right?
Right.
So you have to, I believe you treat everyone fairly and with respect, and you put in your work, and it'll rub off. And if it doesn't rub off, then guess what? See you later. You don't have to play here. You know, and that goes to that transfer portal, which at this point is sort of like supermarket sweep. It's unbelievable what's going on there. But I think it's good for the mid-majors, for what it's worth. So that's how I got into college coaching. It was a meeting with Saturday. He took a shot on me, and I ended up at Fordham with the men. And then, as Steven knows, a few weeks later with the women.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I didn't know about the squeegee story. That's the first time I've heard that, and it doesn't surprise me. It's funny, like when you first came to Fordham, you know, I think the majority of the team were freshmen, so we were all new. But you had like this, like I don't know what it was. Maybe it was like your style, the way you talk, what you said, but you had this way of like making everybody very comfortable, and it like immediately it was like you knew us for like 47 years, you know what I mean? And I think that played a big role into when it came into the matches since day one, because we knew we could trust you. Like we knew, like, you know what I mean? Like it was different. It was very, very natural, I felt, at least for me. I actually want to talk about your, because this is a great story and people need to hear it. I want to talk about your first match. Do you remember, not even your first dual match, our first tournament in the fall? Do you remember your first, I would say, I don't know, 20 minutes in your Division I coaching tennis career?
I do.
Do you want to tell the story or should I?
Frank, I you, believe tell, you was, tell it.
You should tell
I
it,
I believe
Frank.
There were five other teams that came to the tournament, right, to our place? There were five teams and us. And Alan Thorns was a freshman, a bright-eyed freshman. Pretty big serve, pretty big mouth, and pretty big ego. And I loved Thornsy from Jump Street. We got along well from the jump, and I felt like Thorns was the type of kid who he was a little maybe he felt a little out of place coming from the West Coast to the East Coast, and it took him a minute and a half, you know, to sort of get acclimated to what we were doing and things like that. And the first tournament, we had five teams come to Fordham, and Thornsy ends up in a match with a kid from St. Peter's. He was a big guy. He was probably 6'4", 6'5", 250. He looked like a DN more than a tennis player, right? And they were out there forever. And they got to a third. And there were people around watching and people on the court. And, you know, we were sending guys in and out to play tournament matches. And, you know, you catch in the air and the kid's saying something to him on the change, and he's saying something to the other guy on the change. So he said, let me go over there and see what Thornsy's doing. And the third was tight. It was no breaks. I don't even think anybody sniffed a break, really. And they were midway through the third, and it was tight, and they were yapping. And which, by the way, I still to this day have no issue with. I don't know why. I feel like some tennis players are soft, and the crowd should be able to get more involved, and you should be able to talk to guys. Well, whatever the case may be. Anyway, so they're yapping at each other, and we're on the change. And as they're walking by, the kid literally bodies Thornsy. I mean, he takes his elbow and his shoulder, and he just throws it at Al. And I saw the whole thing. And his coach at the time was a much older guy who at the time either was staring at the squirrels outside or he needs to take his glasses. I'm not positive, but he missed the whole thing and it happened right in front of him. I was shocked, and I saw the whole thing. And he bodied Stormzy, and I saw it. And when I tell you I'm 4 or 5 hours into my coaching career, and I see that, you know, so I said something to him. I had to. And essentially he said something back. And I told him that if he wanted to body somebody, that he could try and body me outside the fence. And his coach got wind of it. Thorns, I'm not even positive what Thornsy was doing at the time. Okay. He might have been shocked. Okay.
I think he was trying to hold you back, honestly. You were going crazy.
Listen, I don't like that. I saw it, and to react like that maybe was, you know, in retrospect was a mistake. But I told him if he wants to body somebody, he could body me outside the fence.
And you know, I was going to say, Alex, it was really funny watching it from, because I was like on the little balcony area, and I was watching it unfold, the entire thing. And it was the funniest thing because, I mean, Thorns, our teammate, is about, I don't know, six one around that height.
And
this guy was taller than Thorns, so here comes Frank out of nowhere screaming, going crazy, saying like, you want to pick on somebody your own size.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's true. I had dyslexia that day. My numbers were flicked. I went from 5'6" to 6'5" that day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, so Mike comes over and imagine Mike, right? Like total opposite. So he comes over and he pats me on the backside. He says, you're right. I'm like, this kid, blah, 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 blah. And needless to say, we came out of the tournament unscathed. Ironically enough, that match never finished.
Really?
Yeah, they were either 4-3 on serve or 4-all or 3-all in the third, and the rains came and they never finished. And a few weeks later, we played them at their place indoors. And I saw the kid at one, and I patted him on the ass. I said, "Don't let me take you outside this time." And he started laughing. And we had a nice exchange. But you know what? That was the start of a great relationship between me and Alan. And I think the guys on the team realized very soon that. Or very quickly that I was willing to run through a wall for those guys, and very quickly they all hopped on board, and I believe they were willing to run through a wall for me.
Yeah, that's 100%. I think that like that was like boom, we're a family. Like literally, like immediately, and it was very early on. It was very early on, which was awesome. I remember it. It's one of my favorite stories. Funny enough, it's also one of the stories that Frank loves to bring up the most when he's talking to the Connecticut housewives that he's coaching on the weekends. But that's besides the point. But yeah, I mean, Frank, you got stories for days. I mean, you could go on, but I just to kind of take it back earlier, you mentioned your team getting cut your senior year. Yeah. And it's interesting because that trend, and we've talked about it before, Alex, but I'm curious to get Frank's perspective, that trend has only continued to grow even more with men's teams getting cut. Just wanted to get your thoughts on you know, what you think needs to happen from the NCAA, because it just seems like every year, you know, you some of these top schools are dropping their men's tennis program, and it's sad to see.
Well, you know, it's a Title IX issue, and while I'm all right with the idea of Title IX, I'm not positive I agree with all of the ins and outs of it. And I think, you know, it's a situation where, look, if you have a football team and you have 55 guys on scholarship on a football team, and you have to make sure that the men and women, because of the Title IX situation as far as scholarships go, are on the same page, there's a problem. Because the other men's programs are taking a beating or getting cut or whatever the case may be. So I think an adjustment needs to be made. You know, look, I love football more than most. And I'll tell you, it would be nice for every college or university to have a football team. But, you know, maybe they should consider taking football out of the Title IX equation. If that's possible, or to make changes to it, because, you know, a school like Fordham, the women's team has eight. They have eight folks. A fully funded men's and women's team, people don't realize, a fully funded men's team is 4.5. A fully funded women's team is 8. Okay, you have a football team at Fordham with 55 scholarships or whatever it is. Teams are in jeopardy of either being cut, men's teams or scholarships, and that's a major part of the reason as to why the men's team at Fordham does not have scholarships. I feel like adjustments need to be made, and this new situation with the NIL, I got to be honest, and I'm probably a minority at this point, and the student athletes are not going to want to hear this, but I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't like the idea of it. I don't like it becoming a business situation. And to be honest with you, I don't love the transfer portal either, because I feel like the transfer portal, you know, it's not teaching our kids. I don't think it's teaching or sending our kids the right message, right? So it's sort of a situation where, okay, well, a guy, he's a five-star or blue chip or whatever he is, and he comes in and he's not starting, so instead of working harder, he just puts his name in the transfer portal and transfers out, right? It puts coaches in bad situations, right? I mean, I coached the 40th ranked player in the country at St. John's, and he transferred for grad school. Well, guess what? He's on a full scholarship. So, you know, so now as a coach, I'm running around trying to fill that full because he decided at the end that he wants to transfer or whatever the case may be. It puts coaches in tough situations. I don't like the NIL and the transfer portal. I don't love either. I also think it's made recruiting, you know, coaches that can talk to kids and bring kids in that maybe wouldn't normally come in are at a disadvantage there, because a coach that doesn't know from Shinola can go on the transfer portal, find a guy that's a 13.5 UTR that has good results and bring him to a school because he's going to throw money at him. You know, I don't think that people realize, you know, Fordham is a $70,000 a year university. Okay. If you're getting a full ride there, that means in 4 years, you're essentially locking into $280K. How many, what's the average salary of an adult in the United States of America? It's not $70,000. And you're throwing 17, 18, 19 year olds, $70,000 a year so that they can get their degrees. That's great. Why do they need more? Why do they need to get paid? Why do they need these stipends? Why do they need all these things? It's become a business, and the NCAA, I feel like, has become corrupt, and it's a shame, because I feel like some of these kids, well, I'll give you a perfect example. The kid at Baylor, right? When I was at St. John's, I brought a kid from Baylor and he wanted to transfer. Right, the kid was playing 4 or 5 when he was a freshman. Okay, his junior year, when Boland came in and brought in a ton of guys, okay, by the time Boland was done recruiting, he was the 12 at Baylor. So now he's not playing anymore, and there's no way he's going to sniff the lineup. So we bring him in, okay, he's going to play top 2 or 3 for us. Okay, which is a home run for the mid-major or the school that's not top 25 in the country, right? We're essentially getting their guys that are not going to, right? But for me, it's kind of like, well, where's, you know, there's no, I don't want to use the word loyalty, but in reality, I mean, where's the loyalty and commitment from the player? And it, I just feel like it makes coaches, it gives us a tougher situation when guys can come and go whenever they want.
Yeah, that's tough.
That's an interesting perspective.
Well, I when I was playing, the rule was if you were going to transfer, you had to sit out of here. Okay. Another rule was that they were able to essentially nix schools that you were able to transfer to. So, in other words, if I'm playing at Fordham, Fordham could turn around and say, well, you're not allowed to transfer inside the A-10. But you can go to any other school in the country you want. Now, you put your name in the portal, you could take your name out, you could put it in, you could get picked up, you could not get picked up. It's literally like supermarket sweep. It's crazy.
Don't you need to get approval from the coach, though, to get to transfer? Like, wasn't that a rule as well?
Apologies for the viewers. We got a little technical difficulties. In the meantime, yeah, take a look at Frankie's beautiful blue eyes. Hey, he's back.
I'm back.
Did you
say that again, Alex? I'm sorry.
So I was saying, you know, I thought coaches had a say in whether or not you were allowed to transfer. So, like, doesn't the coach have to sign off on the player's ability to be posted or listed on the transfer portal? Or is that no longer a thing? So that's no longer a rule. Okay. So basically, they have the freedom to do whatever the f*** they want.
That's they what can, I'm saying.
Yeah,
it's crazy. It is wild.
Back to the getting paid thing, though. Because what about these guys that?
Wait, okay. Stevie, before you say that, can we just clarify, Frank? Can you clarify exactly what you're referring to, like the new changes, just for viewers who don't know what you're talking about?
So the NIL is the name and image and likeness thing, right? So it's essentially, it's become a business to where, I mean, the freshman quarterback at Alabama this year made something like $500,000 or $1 million. The guy didn't even play a snap. But I don't know what it costs to go to Bama, but $50,000-$60,000 a year. So that kid's on a full scholarship. Okay. He's getting his education for free, which essentially at the end of the day is worth $200,000-$250,000, whatever it is at Bama, right? Or whatever, wherever it's going. Okay, and then he's getting paid on top of it like a professional player, and he hasn't played a snap.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure about all that.
But the only argument against that is like that money, instead of paying him, where would it be going? Like, who is it hurting that kid that possibly can get injured on the first snap, right, and never get to live up his amazing career in the NFL? And why shouldn't he, if Gatorade wants to come in and sponsor him, why not? It's he's worked his butt off his entire life as a kid and has found a way to get onto the top program, and he's the star player now. Why not? It's not like it's saying okay, that money can either be going to the NCAA or it can be going to I don't know, some charity or whatever. Like that money is either going to be spent on a college athlete or more money is going to be spent on a professional athlete. So I guess my point is, like, why this big deal about waiting 3 years, 4 years, whatever, till they go pro, when in reality it's like that kid can get injured and he might not get a chance to make that check at the pro level,
especially in a sport like football. Like, that's sports, high risk sports. That's a really good point.
Well, I, you know, we brought up Title IX before and equality and all that other stuff. Let me ask you a question. How many field hockey players in the country you think are getting NILs? How many tennis players you think are getting NILs?
Not much.
What about fencers?
Not many.
Yeah, it's not.
Crew, track and field? You see what I'm getting at or not?
Yeah.
Yes.
The other thing is that it – And this is maybe selfishly coming from a coach. It puts a lot of pressure on both coaches and think about this, right? Let's say I'm a football coach, or if you want to do tennis and say that maybe some guys will get NILs, that's fine too. Okay? Let's say I'm a tennis coach. I have 4.5. I'm fully funded, and I've used 3.5 scholarships already. I've allocated them. They're done, and I have 1 scholarship left. And I'm talking to you for the last 3 months on and off. And I turn around to you and say, hey, Alex, you know what? You're my guy. I'd like to give you the full scholarship. I'd like you to sign an NLI. I'd like you to come in and sign an NLI or whatever. And Stephen Duca, the number one tennis recruit in the country, turns around and says, oh, coach, by the way, I'd like to come because your school will give me $50,000 to just sit on the pine all year long and not start, right? Well, now, here's a real problem, right? Do I bring in Alex, who I've been talking to for the last 3 months, who I like very much, or do I bring in the number one recruit in the country because he wants cash?
Mm.
Okay. Mm. I don't like the idea of the NILs, and I don't love the transfer portal thing, because let me ask you a question. Like, honestly, if you're the number 7 player, and this is an age old question that I've heard a million times for the last 30 years. Okay. Would you rather be the number 7 player on an NCAA championship tournament team, or would you rather be the number 1 on the 30th ranked team in the country?
NCAA championship team, 100%.
Okay. But now, I would say the same thing. But here's the thing. The kid that's the 7 needs to work his ass off to get into the lineup, right? The kid that's the 1 can coast. Okay? He can coast. So if the kid doesn't want to work and put in the work, he could just put his name in the transfer portal and tell other coaches, hey, you know what, it didn't work out, or whatever the case may be, I'd like to transfer somewhere else. And he goes somewhere else. Now, I mean, obviously, as a coach, you got to do your homework now and call the other coach and find out what the story is. But if you look, that transfer portal is wild. And there are names on there that are big names. I mean, look what Baylor did in the transfer portal. I'm pretty sure they brought in 2 guys from Duke. They brought in Charlie Broome to play 6 over there. He was playing 1 at Dartmouth. And they made it to the national final last year. Under their assistant, Mike Woodson, who was essentially the interim head coach because Boland had gotten canned. And, I mean, they did work on the transfer portal. They brought in all these kids. And the next thing you know, they're a national title contending team. That's crazy, because the year before and the year before that and the year before that, they were top 25, but they weren't sniffing NCAA titles.
So do you think that this ability to kind of transfer wherever you want, do you feel like it disadvantages specific schools within Division I tennis? Or do you feel like kind of because some mid-major schools are getting major players as well now, like,
right,
you know, you have right. you have guys who have a 5th year who want to go to grad school, who are now like, you know what, I have 1 year left and I want to go to a school like Fordham because Fordham has a good business school and I can just, you know, transfer over and they'll play number 1 and they'll win 80% of their matches because they're, you know, they're sick. So do you feel like this whole transfer portal situation is actually, I mean, which way do you think it's working? Do you think it's benefiting specific schools, or do you think it's kind of all across, it's just more chaotic, but it's kind of equal?
I think it's very much helping the mid-majors and the schools outside the top 25.
So isn't that a good thing?
For the mid-majors, yes, 100%. It is. You know, not to say that the number 1 player on a the 30th ranked team in the country can't go in a transfer portal and play, you know, 4, 5, or 6 for a team that's inside the top 25. but I think you'll get more the opposite. More the situations like that was at Baylor, where the kid was five, he ends up being the 12, and then he wants to transfer. I think that will help the mid-major schools and will help the schools outside the 25 for sure, the top 25 for sure. And I think as far as parity goes, that it's beneficial, the transfer portal. But I feel as far as the development, because let's call a spade, 99% are not going to go on to play pro tennis, right? So this is their last hurrah. This is it, okay? So, I mean, you know, you get four eligible years, and that's the end. I know COVID, obviously, is a situation, but that's a little unique. But I think it helps teams outside the top 25, and it helps parity. But I'm not positive it's really teaching our kids, you know, to have to work for – to get into the lineup or to put in work to do things like what kind of precedent are we setting here?
Yeah, that's a good point. Sure. 100%, that's a good point. Yeah, it goes to show that, you know, I just always feel like there are, you know, players that don't have a good relationship or whatever, or there are players that actually legitimately need to transfer because it's just not a good fit and they pick the wrong school. And I believe that. But then I feel like now you have an increased percentage of players that are just selfish and they're like, well, you know, because at the end of the day, it's interesting because tennis is an individual sport. Ooh. But you have all these players that have spent their entire lives playing an individual sport going into a team environment. And it's very difficult to let go of that, you know, selfishness that you've basically developed for your entire career. So that question that you brought up of would you rather be number one at like a really good school or be, you know, forget seven, six, seven, eight, whatever, last man on the bench. Like literally the person that's getting made fun of on the you know, the NCAA winning team. You know, I feel like a majority of tennis players are going to take the number one because, you know, you're designed that way. You're designed to be, it's all about you, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
One thing I'll also add, I think that you know, if you're coming onto a team, and I've heard of, you know, the reason I say this is because I've heard of a couple situations that have happened, you know, to specific teams where a kid will come on and if he doesn't like the team, you know, if he doesn't like, if they don't, maybe, you know, especially with COVID, you don't really get to spend as much, you know, intimate time with your teammates, right? You don't get to go out as much. You don't get to go to, you know, team events or whatever. So if you don't feel a sense of connection immediately, they immediately put themselves on. Like, it's almost like they immediately make the decision to go transfer, and then that's it. And then they don't even put the effort in to get to know the guys because they know they're going to go. You know, they know they're getting out of there.
So yeah, it's like, and that's a great point. And that's why it's tough to be able to recruit because, you know, you'll get some coaches, they look at rankings and UTR. That's all they look at. Right. Okay.
Well, that just – you know, go ahead. Sorry, go on. Go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, I was going to bring up the UTR. See, we didn't have UTR when I was playing, okay? But UTR now should be used as a baseline, okay? I had a situation. I recruited the kid heavily. Kid was a 13-4 UTR. Thought he was going to come in and play top two. Kid was losing at five, freshman.
Wow.
Okay? You get other situations where – even at Fordham, I think Fabian, when he came in, was like a nine.
I think it was less than that.
He was less than that. Yeah, he was like an eight something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if Fabian's ass ever stepped into the goddamn court and took a ball early, he'd be a better player even. But Fabian,
he got an ATP point, by the way. I don't know if you know this, but he got an ATP point.
I didn't, but I'm glad to hear that. I'm proud of him, and he's a good boy, and I'm glad that he's doing well, and I wish him all the best. And I'm glad to hear that. I think there's a lot of things that go on in recruiting. You know, are the parents psychos? I don't want to deal with them. I don't, and normally the apple don't fall far from the tree. So if the parents are psychos, chances are the kids probably got a little psycho in them, right? Okay. If I have good conversations with the parents and good conversations with the kid, and I feel good about a kid that's an 11.5, okay, and then I have an 11.8 or 11.9 who I don't really know if I feel so great about him, I'm taking the 11.5. The UTR should be a barometer and a baseline, and there are two things that I used to look at in UTR. Okay. Number one is, has the kid had a steady progression throughout his career, okay? You know, and is he still trending upward, right? Is there still more potential to tap into? And the other thing is, I look at big wins. I used to look at. So if you're a 12 UTR, but you beat a 13 and a 13-2 and a 13-4, but you've lost some bad matches, that tells me, a couple things are going on. Number one is that you have the potential to beat guys at a higher caliber, and we need to get you there, okay? And then the other question that's asked is, well, why did you lose to the guys that were 11s? What was going on that you lost to the guys on the 11s? Were you injured? Did your girlfriend break up with you? Did you have an issue? You know, I want to see guys that have had steady progression up the rankings, and the other thing is that show me that they have potential in their wins to tap into, and that we can get better and we can get him better. And high character guys, conversations with parents have turned me off of guys and turned me on to guys. And I think that's the one thing that I could definitely commend Mike Sauter on is making that team a charismatic team, a close bunch. And I think, you know, those 3-3 matches, those were yours because of the fight and the, you know, you don't want to lose for a friend or a teammate, you know what I mean? And there are some guys who are individual guys, there are guys and they don't give a shit. And those guys that were afforded them were not like that.
Do you know, you mentioned stories where parents turn you off or where you've had to, you know, you deal with psycho parents. What do you have some stories from recruiting where you saw a situation and you backed out immediately, or you kind of pulled the plug on it based on the fact that it was either parents or something the kid did?
not in particular as far as recruiting goes. I think parents, you know, look, I appreciate input from any parent, and I want to know that they're there and what's been going on and what they're thinking and what their expectations are and things like that. But, you know, I've had parents sort of tell me, look, he's going to come in and play top two for you, and he should get a full scholarship and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm just like, hey, man, you know, everyone's got opinions, you know, what everybody else has, you know what I mean? So I just, you know, but then on the flip side, I've had parents that have been sweethearts and they've turned me on a little more, you know, that they're hardworking, they come from good families, that they're supportive and they'll come to the mat, whatever the case may be. But I definitely think that, for sure, the player now is different than the player 20 years ago. Okay, and I'll tell you right now. Okay, when I was playing, right, you had to kill me. You had to kill me. I had no weapons. I used to roll the ball until your eyeballs fell out of your head. I used to roll the ball, right? Okay, and that worked all the way throughout high school, and the states, Empire State Games was my big break. I happened to get lucky that four guys from New York State were going to nationals, and I happened to play well in qualifying, and I made the Empire State team, and that's when I really started getting recruited by more and more schools. But I was the type of guy who used to go bananas making a 40th ball on a full stretch and having the guy dump one into the net and him wanting to lose his mind. Okay. That's what got me going. The guy now is 6 feet beyond the baseline. He's 6 feet off the doubles alley. And he hits a spot that's this big that he's going to make one out of 900, and he makes it and he goes crazy. But the other 899 times you're going to miss, guy. You know what I mean? I almost rather you miss now. This way you don't do it again.
So, Frank, you talk about driving people crazy on court. Do you have any stories as a junior where someone lost it on you and you kind of, because obviously, like you said, you ruffle feathers, you know? So it's like if someone comes at you, you know, you go at them with your big calves, your big traps, and then that's it. So do you have any stories from juniors where
I'm the type of guy, look, as far as I'm concerned, Dave Verditti had over at TCU, he's the head guy at TCU. I met Verditti a couple of times. And he, I don't know what happened in the Big 12 a few years ago, but he came up with an idea about something about the crowd being able to yell or get rowdy during points or after points or whatever. Essentially, it was a situation where it was okayed by the conference for the year. I'm the type of guy that believes tennis is a chess match, right? It's 1v1. There's no coaching going on on the pro tour and on the college level, you got one or two coaches doped out among 6 foot. Okay, I'm not sitting there holding him, and you don't want me sitting there holding him. Okay, so it's you against the other guy. Period and end. And there were, I believe that crowds and guys should be able to talk smack to each other, and why not? Look, if a guy is a mental then make sure he knows he's a mental and hand it to him. What, you know what I mean? Like, what do you want me to tell you? And there was a situation I had. I was a junior, and I was playing. I played at a small mid-major Division I, and we went to a non-conference match. It wasn't that far away. I won't mention names or anything like that, but we drive an hour, 2 hours, whatever it was, and we were getting off the bus, and there were a ton of guys at the match, Alex. I don't know if it was senior day or what, but it's a non-conference match. It doesn't really mean much. And we get off the bus, and we're warming up, and sure enough, there were two twins on the team who lived in the town next door to me. And we must have played each other 900 times. I hated them. They hated me. I hated their parents, and they hated my parents. Okay? And I saw they were warming up, and all those people were there to see my match. And sure enough, when you got off, when you got up on the lineup, you had to line up against the guy across from you and shake hands with him. And who am I playing? I'm playing one of the twins. Okay? Now, I didn't know coming in that I was – I didn't even know – I didn't do homework like I do now as a coach, right? I didn't know who they had on their team. So we come out, we start warming up, and they're heckling me. Big calves this, big traps that, little guy this, little guy that, okay? And I knew I was better than him, but they were driving me nuts outside the fence, okay? And real quick, it was 4-1, bad guys. And we were on the change. We were sitting. And the way that they had the benches seated, you were sitting pretty close to the guy. And I remember my coach coming over and sitting down next to me. He says, what the hell is going on with you? You know? And I'm like, you know, I'm sick of this guy's friends. His parents are out there. They're all heckling me. I want to kill them all. And my coach was like, look, forget about what's going on outside the fence. Think about what's going on between the lines right now. Okay? You know, get a break, come back in, and get back into this match. And I knew the kid was a head case because I had seen it. So I knew if I came back in the first and won the first, we didn't have to play the second. The match was over. And sure enough, I came back. And it was 6-6, and then the breaker, I hit a forehand winner down the line. I remember like it was yesterday. It was so funny. It's about 20 years ago. And it's set point, and I win the set, and I'm all fired up, and he takes his racket and smash on the ground, right? And he gets the warning, whatever it is. And I know the match is over. We don't have to play the second. And within 5 minutes, it's 3-0. And the entire crowd now is hushed. I might have given them one of these, you know, like keep it down over there, right? And I decided, you know what? Now is the time to dig in. I'm going to dig in. And we were on the change, and I said a few choice words to him about his family members and things like that. And I asked him maybe if his mother wanted to take me on a date later on in the night. And he didn't like it. And I grabbed my racket and I walked over to my side, and he walked over to his side. And something snapped. And he grabbed his racket and he chucked his racket over the net at my head. And I ducked and played dumb. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? Next thing you know, my teammates come running, coaches come running, his teammates come running, and I'm starting a all-out brawl, right? But nobody knows what I've said. And I turn around and I'm like, look, this guy is nuts. Get control of your guy, you know? And his coach grabbed him, and he said he'd seen enough, and he defaulted him. Match was over. And his coach turned around, and he looked at me, and he said, and you, he said, whatever you did, whatever you said, good for you, because this match is over. And so now there's hooting and hollering. Nobody knows what I was said or why the kid snapped or why he threw his racket, and I'm playing dumb. And my coach come over, and he knew. And he patted me on the ass, and he turned around and said, what'd you say? And I said, I asked his mother out on a date later on. And he said, well, you better grab your shit and go to the bus before we get killed. and that's, you know, but listen, I got to tell you something. I firmly believe coaching, playing, whatever the case may be, you know, tennis, if you're a mental that is not the sport for you. It is not. And I made sure that he knew that day. And that was my favorite college story as far as getting into issues. But there's a lot of gamesmanship and things that go on and things that are said, quietly and he didn't like it. And so now it's a story that I tell 20 years later.
Listen, at the end of the day, it's part of college tennis. I mean, you don't commit to play, especially if you're going to play D1. You don't commit to play Division I tennis and not expect a few heckles. I mean, I actually have a great story that revolves Frank, my freshman year. I think we were at Army, Frank. And I don't exactly remember what I said, but basically, you know, like when those players that don't call any of the balls out, but like, it's understood when the ball's out and you just continue. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm playing the set, whatever it's I'm down a set and it's like 4-all or something. The second set, deuce point. Right. Mm-hmm. So I hit a first serve about yay out. Okay. This guy who hasn't been calling any balls out the entire match decides I'm not going to call it. I'm going to hit it. Obviously I'm not going to go for it. The ball's 2-3 feet out. And he decides to say, come on. And now all of a sudden he's up a break. Now you can imagine me now. I'm looking around, like looking at the team, looking at his coach, looking at you guys. And funny enough, I was right behind his team, like right behind his team. And a few words were said. I don't exactly remember what I said, but one of his teammates goes and tells his coach, rats me out to his coach. To which now at the end of the match, after the match is done, you know, Coach Mike comes up to me and goes, hey, did you say this to that person? And I was like, no, me? Were we watching the same match? Absolutely never. Not. What are you talking about? I would never. What are you kidding me? he's like, okay. I just wanted to make sure. I just went, yeah, come on, coach. Come on. Don't be crazy. literally, I think it was like after we got lunch, like after the van ride, like people already forgot about it. Frank comes up to me and goes, hey, did you say this and this to that guy? And I was like, yeah, I did, coach. And he goes, all right, good boy. Here's a Jolly Rancher. It's one of my favorite memories.
That is hilarious. So, one other, you know, you talk about, you know, you coached obviously Fordham, then Nicholls State, and then St. John's. You know, from what I hear, you have an absolutely legendary story from St. John's with your run when you made the NCAAs, right? Mm-hmm. So can you tell that story for those, you know, for those who don't know?
Side note, probably the craziest, I think the craziest college tennis match that's ever happened. Anyway, continue.
Well, it's certainly the craziest college tennis match I've ever been part of, as a player or a coach. That's for certain. We, we were the one seed going into the Big East tournament. And I feel we had won maybe 14 matches in a row at the time going into the Big East tournament. It was down in South Carolina. And I got to be honest, the week going in, there was a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure to win. You had a rookie head coach in Potash. We had tons of meetings about, you know, between practices and tactics. And, you know, these are obviously teams that we had seen earlier in the year. We drew Xavier in the first round, a team that we had beaten pretty handily, during the season. And I feel like there was a lot of pressure felt. You know, we had six seniors on the roster. We were the one seed. We were expected to win, or, you know, whatever expectations, right? But the goal at the end of the day was to win the tournament. We draw Xavier, and I remember we lost the doubles point. And from top to bottom, we were, you know, we were significant Xavier, but we, you know, the doubles point had eluded us throughout the year, and we were much significantly stronger at singles than doubles. And you know what? I take blame for that. I feel like you can tell how well a team is coached, and I'm going off on a tangent here. You could tell how well a team is coached by the way they play doubles. And I'm going to tell you why I feel that wholeheartedly. Because as juniors, you don't play a lot of doubles. It's all singles. You, truth be told, you guys don't know what the f*** you're doing in doubles when you get to college. 85% of guys have no clue what they're doing in doubles. And I feel like it's taught. And there's a lot of work that goes into the doubles point and getting the doubles point. And the doubles point in college tennis, as you guys know, is huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Because then all you got to do is split the six and the singles, right? So we lose the doubles point against Xavier. And I thought to myself, I remember we got in the circle. And, you know, it was sort of, you know, do I give these guys a wake-up call and scream and yell at them? Or is it more like, you know, all this pressure is going to eat at us, right? And so we end up winning four matches pretty quickly. We beat Xavier 4-1. We go back to the hotel room, and the following day we have DePaul, who's a tricky out. DePaul actually last year won the Big East tournament. They were tricky at the top. We come out flat again a little bit, and we had a rain delay, and I believe the rain delay helped us. Because we were able to get back into the hotel room and settle in and sort of take a deep breath and get back to, you know, relaxing a little bit. And we had dinner that night together. And we came back the next day and we played them tough. And we beat DePaul 4-1. And simultaneously, the way that they did in the Big Ten is simultaneously Marquette was playing Butler. They were the two and the three seeds. And I remember telling Potash the week prior, the only team that I thought could beat us was Marquette. We had beaten Butler 4-0 during the year, and we had we were a bad matchup for Butler. But on the flip side, Marquette was a bad was not a great matchup for us. And Marquette was the one team that you know, we would prefer not to play if we didn't have to. And ironically enough, when our match was done, we ran over to the other match. There were a bunch of people at the match. And Butler had three match points at 3-all, and the kid chunked them. And Marquette came back and won the match 4-3. And so, I you're going to have a headache on your hands the following day. And for me, The biggest goal as a player in college was to make the tournament. And I was determined, and so was the rest of the coaching staff, to get these guys as prepared as possible the following day to be able to beat Marquette and make the tournament. And I remember holding a meeting in my hotel room the night before. And, you know, at the time, you have six seniors, you have guys who know each other, you have a full year under your belt. And, you know, I pretty much told the guys, listen, I don't want to hear about feelings. I don't want to hear about, you know, guys worrying about getting upset. Here's what I want to know. Okay. I want you guys to divulge who you want on your court, who you want watching your court, and who you feel most comfortable there. And we literally mapped out court to court and what the six guys that were sitting, who was going to be on whose court, who was going to tell who if things weren't going well or whatever the case may be. So the doubles point was big in the match because I didn't know if Marquette could find four in singles, but I knew they could find three. And the doubles point was big. And we split it 1-2. It went to three. And we lost in a tiebreaker at third doubles. So we're stuck 1-0. And, you know, obviously it's a big occasion. It's being televised and ESPN is there and so on and so forth. And I felt like when we got in the huddle after the doubles, it was the first time where I felt like, oh, you know, these guys are a little tight. So I was placed between 1-2. And I remember, like yesterday, the thought process going in. Our six was the best six in the Northeast, period and end. He was 18-1 on the year. He had won 16 matches in a row. The only match he lost was a tiebreaker at Princeton in a match where he had match points. So we were pretty confident at what was going on at six. Our one was the best player in the conference. Andre was the best player in the conference, and we felt comfortable up there. The number two was the reigning Big East player of the year, Alan Nunez. He was a fifth-year senior. We were confident in what he could do with two. And we were confident that we could find four, but we knew it was going to be tough. And I remember we were doing well at 1-2, and sure enough, two guys come running onto the court and say, Coach, OT is having a tough time at six, and Baca's losing five. And OT's having a tough time at six. What do you mean? The guy's he's won 16 matches in a row. Like, what do you mean? So I go running over there, and our number six, he the occasion was big, and he couldn't let the racket go. He wasn't accelerating. He was guiding the ball, and big game, big kid, great kid, great kid. 6'4", 6'5", Serbian kid, lefty, tough game, big game, and he couldn't find it. And simultaneously, the court next to him, our number five, is down a set and a break, and we're in trouble. We're in trouble, and it's 90 degrees outside, and so we lose at five, and Marquette goes up 2-0. And OT, we tried at six, and he couldn't find it, and we're down 3-0 now. Okay? And everyone that was there from Marquette had surrounded court four, and one of the guys came over, and I asked what was going on at four, and our number four was up 5-0 in the first and proceeded to lose 12 out of 13 games and was down 7-5-4-1.
Jeez.
So we're down 3-0, and my guy at six is very upset on the bench, and I know as much as I want to console him, I know we're two matches away from getting swept, and that's it. So we're still fighting on courts 1-3. We felt good about what was going on up there, and I ran to four. And our guy was pretty dejected, head down, 12 out of 13 games. He's got the towel over his head. And I sat next to him, and I gave him – he had a world-class forehand, world-class. But his tactics and his court positioning – He frayed from the baseline, 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, and the other kid was counterpunching. And the tactic, the only thing I said was I told him, look, I want 70-30. I want you hitting 70% forehands, okay? And I want you to hit it. But you have to step into the court because this kid's counterpunching and he's seeing it because you're so deep beyond the baseline. And And before he got up on the change, and I said, and I want you to know something else. I said, you're going to win this match for us. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? And he looked at me, and he saw me, and he shook his head, and he went, and we get a break and a hold. And now it's 4-3. And simultaneously to that, our number three lets out a scream, and he's one. And now it's 3-1. And we're on the changeover again, and I gave him no tactics. And I told him, same thing, nothing changes, okay? And he got up, and I looked at him, and I said, I want you to know something. I said, I want you to know you're going to clinch this match for us. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? And he looked at me, and he said, yes. And he went out, breaking a hold, and now it's 5-4, okay? And as it becomes 5-4, our number two has won, Alan has won, and now the score is 3-2. And now you could tell the 100-and-something fans that had flown down from Chicago, it went from a rowdy bunch to a pretty quiet bunch quick. And the momentum had turned, and Andre was in the third at one, and we were confident, even though that kid was a tough out for Marquette. And we were on the change, and I didn't say anything to him this time until he got up. And he stood up, and I grabbed him by the shirt, and I looked at him, and I said, you look at me. And I said, I want you to know that when this match is over, okay, you are going to clinch it for us. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? And he looked at me, and he said, I'm going to f-ing win. And he went to the baseline, and he served out the set, and we win the second 6-4. And as we win the set, Andre wins the third at one, and now it's 3-3. And it was 3-3, and all eyes were on court 4. And funny, I still to this day break Dylan's chops. Dylan was so jammed up about the situation, right? He was on the other bank of the courts. I still tease him about this, and he was pacing. Dylan was pacing. And I had been with our four, with Dootsie, for an hour and a half at this point, and was like, well, you know, we're not going to change anything, right? And I think for the next 15 minutes, I don't think he missed a ball. I don't think he missed a ball. And we were up 4-love in the third. And, you know, it's funny because you don't want to lose a game. Right, because who knows at this point what's going to go on in this match, right? And I remember the 4-0 game, and I remember turning around to the trainer who was there, and I said, "Listen, this is a big game. We win this game, we put our foot on his throat. But if he wins it, you know, it could get interesting." And sure enough, the kid from Marquette didn't want to go away, and 4-0, okay, became 5-4. And we're on the change, and my guy starts cramping. And I made a mistake. I made a mistake that could have cost us. But so men's and women's rules are different in Division I. If you call for an injury, for a trainer, rather, I'm sorry, it's a point, okay? And the trainer came out. And I told the chair that we needed a timeout, and the head coach at Marquette went to the chair and was talking to her. And next thing you know, we're getting a point penalty, and I fought it as much as I could. But how we used it was I said to him, I said, "Listen, okay, they're going to try and take this match from you. Don't let them do that." Don't let them do that. And I think it lit a fire under him. We went to a tiebreaker, and we won. We won 7-4 in the third set tiebreaker. We were down 3-0, 5-7, 1-4. And we came back, and we won, and they ambushed him. And it's probably the only time where, still on video, you could actually see me crying, I think, when that happened. It was so emotionally draining. the magnitude of the situation, the way that the whole thing went down, that was probably top five all time in my life. To be able to celebrate with those guys and go to NCAAs, those guys were kings for a week. They played in Corneseca Hall, and as soon as you walked in, the final point, I must have watched the final point 100 times. And I was so proud of those guys. They held a nice banquet thing for us and a selection show when we drew Virginia. And it was a tremendous, tremendous experience. The Big East final was tremendous. The NCAAs were tremendous. To play the number 5 team in the country, who by the way, their number 2 was Brandon Nakashima.
Stop.
Yeah. Their number 2 was Nakashima.
That is insane.
Imagine. Guy made U.S. Open two years in a row, and he was playing us at 2. Okay, so their 1 was 3 in the country, and Nakashima played 2. And I remember watching film on Nakashima. And I told Dylan, I said, this kid's a problem. I'm not positive what we can do here. He's got a plus serve. He's got an A-plus second serve. He takes the ball early. He hits the ball as clean as a whistle. He hugs the baseline. He's a nightmare, this kid. And the thought was, well, we have a senior, a 22-year-old senior playing a 17-year-old freshman. Maybe he'll fold under pressure. Yeah, he didn't. He didn't. But we were up in 2 matches, by the way. We were up a set and a break on 6, and we were up a set on 3 when they called the match. So we gave Virginia all they could handle, and they end up winning 3 more matches and making it to the Elite 8 or something like that and bowing out there. But it was a tremendous experience. It was the best college tennis match I've ever been a part of. I was so proud of those guys and the coaching staff, and I'm glad that I was a part of that.
That is insane. That might be one of the best college tennis stories, if not, like, that is one of the best college tennis stories out there for sure.
I'm pretty sure that's what I said when before he started telling that story, because I've heard it a couple of times, I think, Frank. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's sick, man. I mean, listen, you got to get back into college coaching, because I know you. I know you miss it. I know you miss it. You got to get back into it.
I miss the players, if you want to know the truth, well, I don't think college coaches get paid enough money. I mean that. And I also think the coaches that have to coach the men and the women shouldn't be. It's too much. It's too much work. It's too much work to go to a 3-day tournament on Long Island at Hofstra, okay, with the men. Come back on a Sunday at 4 in the afternoon to go back to campus to hop on a bus for 6 hours to drive to Syracuse with the women to play them the day after. It's not right. There's not enough time. And to do it properly, the way that the good coaches do, between the recruiting and dotting the I's and crossing the T's and being on the up and up and doing the right thing, there should be 2 coaches at bare minimum, if not 4, okay, a head and an assistant. Now, I understand that funding is an issue and things like that, but no coach in the country should be coaching both teams. And Greg Harkins down in Nickel State, guys like that, it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. A lot of work. It's a lot of recruiting. It's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. You know, there's a lot of travel. I mean, when we were down in Louisiana, I remember being down in Louisiana and Craig Harkins, who I learned a lot from as well. Down there. I learned a lot of things about alligators and other things down there, tigers and bears. Oh my! You know, he says to me one day, he says, you know, we're going on the road in 10 days or whatever, and we're going to be gone for 7 days. Oh, where are we going? Okay, well, we're going to Florida. Okay, well, when's the flights? What flights? What do you mean, what flights? Well, we're driving. We're driving from southwestern Louisiana to Florida. How long is that ride? Oh, 13 and a half. No big deal. 13 and a half. No big deal. We drove through 19 states to get to Florida. You know what I mean? And then when you get to Florida, you play 6 matches in 7 days, whatever it is, and then you drive back 13 hours. I was like, Greg, nothing. Yeah, if we gotta go more than 3.5 hours, we're flying. He says, no, we don't do things like that. And we got on the bus and we drove, men and the women. 14, 16 players, 2 coaches. Coaches should not – tennis coaches should not be coaching both teams, period and end.
Yeah, no, that's absurd to drive. I mean, to drive that amount, first of all, that's – I think the longest we've had to drive was like 8, and that was unbearable. But I know what you mean. It's unfortunate as well because you're right. Like, there isn't enough funding to support entire programs. And then it's like, how do you compete? You know, how do you compete as a program when your coach is only able to give you half the time? Like, how is that when other programs have like 2-3 coaches? It's insane. It's absurd. It's like, I feel like that in itself should be a rule, like a regulation, you know, it shouldn't be. So it's,
I agree wholeheartedly. And I think Stephen, you know, he can attest that. Yeah, and the guys at St. John's too. We put in too much work. Good coaches. Listen, I'm going to get into trouble if people watch this, but there are some college coaches out there. They're robbing universities. They're robbing universities. I mean that.
Yeah.
And they're robbing the kids of the right experiences. When you get coaches that are dedicated and doing things that they should be doing and really putting in the time and the effort and the work. It's a lot of work, and to coach 2 teams for what? Why? Does anyone else in Division I, do they coach 2 teams? No, it shouldn't be like that. They should split it up 100%. And I'll tell you another quick story, actually, that I'm thinking about. When I was down at Nicholls State, we played LSU, okay? The men and the women. LSU, as a side note, has a live tiger in the cage on campus. Okay, just say it.
That's insane.
Okay. They have a $20 million tennis facility there. They have play site on every court, indoor, outdoor. It's probably one of the nicest facilities that I have been to in the country last year. And anyway, we took the women there. And LSU was top 20 in the country at the time. And we had a meeting prior to the match. And the women's coach made it clear that we were going to play clinch. Okay. So for those that don't know, clinch means once the match is clinched at 4 points, okay, essentially the match is over and you walk off no matter what the scores are, right? We wanted to play it out because for us and our kids, it's a good experience for kids to get burned and play a top 20 team in the country and prep them for tough conference matches and things like that. And so we had a back and forth and so it's her decision, and they're top 25, and we decide, okay, we're going to play clinch, right? So sure enough, we win the match at 6, and it's 3-1. Okay, and my one, who was 61 in the country, who sent my son a teddy bear a couple of years ago, she's one of my favorite female players of all time, Stephanie Barnett, she was giving their one all she could handle. They were late in the third, okay? And LSU win the fourth match, and it's 4-1, so the match is over. So players are shaking hands, they walk off the court. And the women's coach turns around and says, well, let's play it out. Let's play it out. Why? Because we took a point? And because 6-1 to you looks better than 4-1? No. We decided beforehand that we're not going to play it out. So that's the end of it. So I said, no, we're out of here. See you later. Okay. And Harkins, super good guy, man. He just reached out to me for my 40th birthday, and I hope he's well. You know, he grabs me, and I'm fired up. And I'm like, this, we're out of here. Like, we talked about this beforehand. We didn't want to play clinch. We wanted to play it out. Now that we've won a match, she wants to play it out. We're out of here. And Harkins turned around and said, no, we're gonna play it out. And sure enough, we lose the 2 matches, and we lose the match 6-1. And we're on the bus, and I'm fired up. fired up. This is shit. We shouldn't have, blah, blah, blah. And to his credit, okay, Harkins turned around and said, listen, you know, we're not top 50 in the country. They're top 20 in the country. We want to keep a relationship. Yeah, but I want to, this is ridiculous. And what was said beforehand, and Greg calmed me down, you know, and he's like, listen, you know, if we want to have a relationship with LSU for years to come, we're going to play out the match. And so I learned a little bit from all three coaches, a lot of it. And one of the things that Harkins taught me was patience and to keep relationships with people for years to come. So to his credit, he calmed me down and we had dinner that night and all was well the following morning.
Frank, it's funny you actually mentioned that story with the clinch, because last time we played St. John's, it was the senior year, so it was the last time, you know, it was the last time we played each other. And you were at that match, and I think Steven, you also showed up, right?
Yeah, we showed up
together. And I remember, yeah, I remember we started playing the match, and we were also, they decided to play clinch. Like, they didn't want to play it out because I think they had a match the following day or something like that. And I remember we were pissed because we wanted to obviously play as many matches as we could, and obviously it's a good opportunity to play a school like St. John's that's better than us. And they, you know, you guys slap us around. I think we lost 4-0 very quickly. Wasn't, you know, much of a match, at least the first four matches. I think Max Green, he was doing well on his court. I think Fabian was also giving your number one some problems at the time. I forget exactly what it was. But you guys beat us 4-0. We get off the court, and then you guys they start to practice.
Yeah.
They start to practice, and I was like, what? I was like, why are you going to clinch the match in order to, you know, save some gas for the next day, and then beat us 4-0, and then continue to practice? Like, as we're like packing up our bags, they're just like grinding on court. It was such a fuck you. I was literally just.
I want to point out that at this point I was an alumni, so I was retired. Yeah. And that was the most embarrassing moment of my career.
Yeah.
watching Matt go.
Look, one of the four agreements is don't take things personally. I you know, it's funny because when we went down to Virginia and played them at NCAA, he had two guys stay after the two guys that were losing to put in work. But I don't think, well, obviously, as far as you go, it's not something that you should take personally. So, I mean, but that's funny. But as far as the team that stays, look, there's always work to be had. Okay. Me personally as a coach, I don't think that I helped any of my players so significantly, men or women, with their technique in my entire coaching career. You guys have hit 9 million balls before you come out. You know how to play. You know technique-wise how to hit forehand, how to hit backhand. Right? Okay. It's little tweaks here and there. But where I believe that I helped the most is between the ears. Okay. I can't tell you how many times I've had players, you know, they're up a set, but they're down a break, right? And it's a coin flip match or whatever it is. And we're on the change, and my player's dejected. And I turn around and I say, listen, if I had told you an hour and a half ago that you were going to be up a set and down a break in the second, would you take it? What's the answer? 100% of the time, it's yes. So that's the position we're in. Why are you dejected? Get your head up. Get your chest out. Get your shoulders up. And show them who the boss, who the best player on the court is. Period and end. Okay? Between the ears is where, you know, and tactically, like, you know, the doubles and stuff like that. But technique-wise, you know, a tweak here or a tweak there is fine. You know, a lot of guys nowadays, they like to stand 16, 17, 27 feet behind the baseline, right? Okay. And they try and hit offensive balls. It's mind-boggling. You know, like, Look, when I played in high school, I was young and dumb. I was dumb as rocks. I didn't know about directional tennis and playing behind guys and when to hit serves where when I was playing doubles and all this other nonsense. I knew to hit the ball in between the lines and get more balls in than the other guy. Okay, I learned so much as a player and then afterwards as a coach. I can't even tell. I learned things at the All-American tournament in Tulsa. I had no idea. And so many things made sense, and so many things make sense now that didn't make sense back then, or I wasn't even thinking. I just – players now, it's like – it's funny. I teach the academy kids up at in Darien at the Canadian Hockey Club, and it's like a guy's getting into a forehand, a forehand round, right? And one guy's got a better forehand than the other. And the guy with the better forehand changes direction of the ball when he's 4 feet behind the baseline. Why? Tell me why. You have a better forehand than the other guy. Why would you switch it? For what reason? Doesn't make any sense. Okay? And I my biggest question as a coach is one word. Why? Tell me why. I want to know. What's going on? Now, you know, it's just aimless. Well, that's a problem, because that means to me that you're not thinking at all about what's going on. You're just hitting the ball aimlessly. There's no plan.
Right.
So many guys
come out without plans. It's wild.
I actually have a good story about that why question. I don't remember exactly what match it was, but I remember I was on the court. We were playing doubles. And for anybody that knows me, they know that I don't have much of a backhand. So I didn't really, you know, I was like, I'm going to play the deuce side and that's going to be fine. And, you know, any of the important points, you know, my partner can take on the returns and I'm going to just get to the net and it'll be fine. At least that's what I told myself. So anyway, you know, it's like, I think it was like 5-4 on serve, but deuce point. And something told me, I don't know what it was. I hadn't taken a single important return returning point in it, throughout the match. Something told me, and I remember Frank was on the court, something told me I needed to take this return. I don't know what it was. You could call it a feeling. I don't know. Anyway, so I go over, I don't even remember who my partner was, but I tell my partner, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take this return. And then I see Frank see us switching formations and seeing the person go to the net and be like, yeah, I'm taking it on the deuce side. And you should have seen his jaw drop. like in slow motion, I could see it's like, no, like this. I'm like, no, trust me. I got it. And in my head, I'm thinking, here's what's going to happen. You better make this return, son. I'm like, one, I have to make this return, right? Two, this guy's got a big kick serve. Ain't no chance I'm hitting a backhand. So I'm just going to, but he had been kicking a lot of his first serves in. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to show him the backhand side. And I'm going to run around it. And if he aces me, like literally a 40-mile-an-hour could have – 40-mile-an-hour serve out wide could have aced me because I already committed to going. So – and I see this guy lining up, and I'm like, I really hope this works. I really, really hope this works because Frank is going to chew me out if it doesn't. And guy, sure enough, kick serve up the tee. I'm way ahead. I'm already like setting up for the forehand. Boom, slap, forehand return. And I just look at Frank. And I'm like, let's go. And Frank's just like I don't even know what to say. And he's just like, well, he's like, all right, good job. And he walks off. And it reminded me, he's like, why? Like, why would you do that?
Because you can. That's why.
Because we can.
That's it. Yeah. No, amazing.
Frankie, thank you so much. Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure, coach.
Listen, I want you two to know, I watched some of the other podcasts, and other than the fact that you had Satter on before me, and I'm salty about it, I think both of you are doing a hell of a job, and I enjoyed this and talking tennis with you guys, and I enjoyed some of the interviews that I heard prior to. Granted. None of them are as interesting as I am. It's not even close. But But I will say I love the work that you guys are doing, and I want you to continue, and I hope it works out. And when you guys make it big, you could bring me back for just maybe 10 minutes and we'll talk.
Thank you, Coach. We'll definitely have you on.
I was going to say, we're putting in the work to bring the eyeballs on you. You know, that's why we waited a little bit. That's why we waited.
That's what I said. I was like, Frank, you know, I know you got all the stories. Just hold off, wait a little bit. But
let's hope the ADs around the country don't start peeping these things, because I'll never get that. But I will end with this. Every one of my players, I've had some sort of relationship after. I've left or after they've graduated. I still have a relationship with quite a few guys from St. John's and quite a few of you guys at Fordham and a handful of Nicholls State players. And my college coaching career, it was a great learning experience. It was a ton of fun. I love my kids. They know that I would run through walls for them, and I believe that they've run through walls for me. And it was tremendous. The whole experience between Fordham and then Nicholls State, and then going to St. John's and having that NCAA run. And I love all my players, and I wish them well and the best in their future endeavors. Because Lord knows if I'm coaching them, they're probably not making the team.
Frank, we love you. And I really hope there are some ADs listening out there, because they're going to, you know, they're going to trip over a diamond right now in the rough. And God bless that next team that you end up coaching in the NCAA, because they're going to have to deal with a crazy coach. But I'm sure they'll have many more wins to expect. So, looking forward to it. Thank you again for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, you know the deal. Like, comment, subscribe. Stay healthy, stay happy, and as always, just slap. Take care.